Lecture 9, A Decade of Debt, the 1980s.
The economic and political story of the 1980s is inextricably tied up with President Ronald Reagan, with his tax policies, his budget policies, his policies about markets and deregulation. But before launching into that story, it seems to me that the true starting point for the 1980s economy is to resolve what happens to monetary policy and the Federal Reserve at the end of the 1970s. Remember, in the 1970s, the Fed is having a terrible time trying to figure out if we fight recession with a loose monetary policy, then aren't we feeding the inflation that we're already suffering as well? In 1979, Jimmy Carter appoints Paul Volcker to be head of the Federal Reserve, as inflation is flying high and will soon be flying higher. Volcker announces a fairly simple approach. As he puts it, his first job is to get inflation under control. In a way, he says, you know, the days of keeping interest rates low to stimulate the economy, those days are over. I'm going to focus on letting the money supply rise at a slow, steady rate. I'm going to break the back of inflation. We're not going to worry about fine-tuning the economy. We're not going to worry about problems of unemployment a whole lot. Instead, I'm going to worry about creating a long-term environment where people really believe that inflation is not going to continue. And with that in mind, he clamps down on the money supply and stops letting it expand as rapidly as it had been expanding before. The result? Interest rates go up sharply. It greatly discourages the demand for borrowing money. Things like purchases of houses and business investment go down sharply. We have the vicious double-dip recession that I mentioned before, which starts in the early 1980 and then continues in through 81 and 82. Volcker more or less says in response to this recession, yeah, it's a recession. Yeah, it's deliberate. I'm going to kill off inflation. That's my job. I'm going to do it. I'm going to take the heat. And he does kill inflation. Inflation comes down from over 9% in 1980 and 1981 to about 4% in 1983 and 84, and it's more like 3% by 1985 and 1986. Volcker felt that it was necessary to break inflation by breaking the cycle of inflationary beliefs. During the 1970s, lots of people are buying things and making economic decisions based on a belief that inflation is going to keep going higher and higher. So, for example, they're borrowing lots of money on the thought that they'll be able to pay it back in inflated dollars. In turn, if everyone believes inflation is going up, then that makes it easier for prices to rise. It makes it easier for wages to rise. And at some level, inflation was becoming embedded in the economy. Volcker essentially needed to prove to everyone that this was not going to happen. And in other words, he was going to say, look, sure, interest rates are going to go up. Sure, the unemployment rate's going to go up. But I'm not going to give. I'm going to break the back of inflation. He basically said, we're not going to bail out the economy with lower interest rates. We're going to break inflation first. Now, in thinking about this episode, Volcker and the recession, it's useful anyway, or maybe even fun, to think about partisan economic statistics and their uses. Think about it for a moment. We have a recession here which starts in 1980 and runs through early 1982. If you hear Democrats talk about the record of Ronald Reagan, what you'll often hear them do is have Carter's presidency go up to, say, 1979, and then Reagan is given credit for everything after 1979, or for all of the 1980s. Now, when you think about that, Reagan isn't elected until November of 1980. He doesn't take office until January of 81, and the policies that he tries to enact don't kick in until 1982 or 1983. So blaming Reagan's economic policies for what happens from 1980 through 82 is truly bizarre. I mean, the timing is just wrong to make that happen. On the other hand, Republicans have a tendency, to some extent, just to look at the world from 1983 on and to sort of take all of the early recession in the 1980s and blame it all on, say, Jimmy Carter or Paul Volcker. Well, you know, there's some justice in that. But it's also true that the economy was at a real trough. It had dropped off in 1982. And so the expansion you see during the 1980s is partly such a strong expansion because it starts from such a low point. And so whenever you bias your numbers by choosing either the starting point just before the recession or the trough just after the recession and everything that follows, you can get some interestingly partisan statistics out of that. My point here is just to say the world is a complicated place, the economy is a complicated place. Most people think, in retrospect, that it was a good thing that Volcker took the stance he did and really knocked inflation on the head. Dividing up the world into who was president at the time is not always the best way to tell an economic story. The most obvious change in the economy during the 1980s were the huge budget deficit and the huge trade deficits. These happened at about the same time, which, as I will explain in a moment, is not a coincidence. And they were often referred to as the twin deficits because these two deficits were happening all at once. Let's first talk about the pattern of budget deficits, and in particular, how that pattern had been since World War II. Remember that there had been explosions in government debt during World War II. We'd fought the war on borrowed money. What had happened since then? Well, there were small surpluses during most of the 1950s, and then small deficits during most of the 1960s, and somewhat larger deficits as we got into the 1970s. But even the deficits of the 1970s were, relatively speaking, kind of small. And so I often think about it this way. Think about two trees that are of roughly equal size. One tree is the debt tree, and the other tree is the GDP tree, measuring the size of the economy. At the end of World War II, these two trees are roughly the same size. The accumulated federal debt is about the same size as the economy. However, in the decades that follow that time, after through the 50s and 60s and into the 1970s, through most of that time, the economy tree, the GDP tree, is growing at something like 6 or 7% a year, once you've taken both inflation and real growth into account. However, the debt tree, even though it's growing somewhat each year as we have more budget deficits, is perhaps only growing at maybe 1 or 2% a year. So if you think about it, with one tree growing a lot faster than the other, the ratio between the two trees is changing. And that's really what's happening, that debt, in that sense, is becoming smaller relative to the size of the economy. Another way of saying this is just to say the debt to GDP ratio is falling. The ratio of debt to GDP is about 100 in 1947, when these two are the same size. By 1960, it was down to 47%. By 1970, the ratio of debt to GDP was 29%. And by 1980, it was still a little lower at 27%. But in the 1980s, the deficits get extremely large. Instead of being maybe 10 or 20 billion a year, or even as high as 60 billion as it got in the 1960s, suddenly the deficit blossoms to over $120 billion in 1982. And then it averages over $200 billion a year from 1983 to 1986. So if you think about our two trees again, now we're in a situation where the economy is still growing somewhat steadily, but all of a sudden the debt tree is growing by leaps and bounds and catching up. The debt to GDP ratio starts to rise. It goes from 27% in 1980 to 44% in 1990 and is headed for more than 50% by the mid-1990s. Why did we get this enormous budget deficits in the early 1980s? What caused them? Let me try and sort out four figures of that time, which I think had some impact on what was going on. The first, of course, is increased defense spending. Reagan builds up the defense budget. Annual defense spending is 40% higher in real dollars in 1986 than it was in 1981. Now, of course, there's been a large argument ever since over whether this was a good idea or not. And frankly, whether it was a good idea is getting a little bit outside my area. But it's at least worth remembering that these defense increases started under President Jimmy Carter. They started right after the Soviet Union had invaded Afghanistan in 1979. And there was a broad bipartisan consensus at the time that it was important to spend more on defense. It was also true that many people, looking back on the 1980s, think that that defense buildup contributed to the collapse of the Soviet Union and the freeing up of Eastern Europe. Now, frankly, I don't know how to judge that argument, but if it did contribute to all of that, then it, you know, is worth something. Maybe not as much as we spent, but it was worth something. Even at its peak, though, in the mid-1980s, if you adjust for inflation, the levels of defense spending in the mid-1980s were lower in inflation-adjusted dollars than what we spent at the peak of World War II, certainly. Also, what we spent at the peak of the Korean or Vietnamese wars. Defense spending, however, flattens out in the late 1980s. Adjusted for inflation, the level of defense spending pretty much doesn't change from 86 through 89. And then under President Bush, a gradual cutback of defense spending starts that continues under President Clinton. From 1989 to 1997, real defense spending, adjusted for inflation, is cut back by one-third. It's roughly back to the level it was at the end of the 1970s after the reductions that followed the Vietnam War. So certainly higher defense spending in the early 80s did help generate those budget deficits, but that sort of reversed itself in the later part of the decade. A second cause of the higher budget deficits, the income tax cut. Ronald Reagan campaigned fiercely for a 30% cut in income taxes, and he got it. That tax cut was controversial then, and it's controversial since. Did it create all the wealth of the 1980s through some kind of a supply side effect? I think the easiest way to think about this is to say that every tax cut has several different dimensions. One is a demand side effect. It just encourages more demand in the economy. A second effect is a supply side effect. That would be encouraging people to save more and to work more hours. And third would be a compliance effect. And the idea of the compliance effect is just that rich people won't try so hard to evade taxes. And so they will pay somewhat more of the lower tax rate than they might have been willing to pay of the higher tax rate. How does the Reagan tax cut stack up on these three dimensions? Well, there's no question that on the demand side, cutting taxes encouraged demand in the economy. That's why some economists say that Ronald Reagan was actually a really Keynesian president. He sort of said, as we said back in the 1930s, the economy's in a steep recession in 81 and 82. What do you do with steep recessions? You cut taxes and you put more demand out there in the economy. There's no question that demand side effect occurred. There's also decent evidence that the tax cut had good effects on compliance. As the top tax rate came down, it seemed true that people stopped putting money into particular specialized kinds of investments which avoid paying taxes or postpone them until later. People were more willing to pay the lower rate than they had been to pay the higher rate. And so the actual share of taxes collected from the wealthy actually goes up somewhat as the tax rate is cut. Presumably the reason for that is that wealthy people are not trying so hard to hide income from the tax man anymore. The supply side effects are much harder to find in the early 1980s. Remember, the supply side argument should be because of lower taxes, people save more or work harder. But personal savings rates are actually declining in the early 1980s. They're not going up, they're going the other direction. And while it's true that there is some extra work effort, mainly because of the entry of second earners, often women, into the economy during those years, it's not huge or overwhelming, and it's hard to connect the economic growth of the 1980s to that relatively small increase in hours worked. There are people who argue that the economy recovered from 1983 through the rest of the 1980s, all because of the supply side effect of the tax cut. But that claim is just far, far overstated. We recovered in part because we were rebounding out of a recession. We recovered in part because oil prices came down. We recovered in part because there were new technological discoveries in electronics and information technology. We recovered in part because the Fed killed inflation. We recovered in part because of deregulatory effects. We'll talk about later in this lecture, and in part because of the demand side effects of the tax cut. Now, my point here is not specifically political, in the sense that Ronald Reagan deserves a fair share of credit for many of the things on this list. I'm not saying Reagan's policies had no effect on it. What I'm saying is that the supply side effects of the tax cut in particular were only one tiny part of the story, much as Andrew Mellon's supply side tax cuts can only be considered a tiny part of the story of what happened during the 1920s. These first two reasons for the high budget deficits, that is, higher defense spending and the tax cut, were sort of eroded over time. Defense spending went back down, income taxes have crept back up over time. But the next two factors I'll talk about have only strengthened with the passage of time. The third factor I want to talk about is expanding Social Security. I've already explained that during the 1970s, these Social Security payments were really rising steadily. In 1983, it was decided that we really needed to save Social Security. It was headed for bankruptcy in the sense that the claims on the system would be bigger than the taxes coming in. So there were a number of small changes made in terms of gradually phasing back the retirement age, taxing some of the benefits received by the high-income elderly, and so on and so on. But the main change was to start building up a Social Security trust fund. Remember, in the past, Social Security was pay-as-you-go, meaning the current generation pays in and the current generation of retired folks get that money right away. The idea now was that Social Security would be building up a system where we would have more and more surpluses built up in the account over time. And that would mean we could draw down that account at some point in the future. By the later part of the 1990s, the Social Security Fund is saving at a rate of up to $60 billion a year and more. Now, for somebody like me, born in 1960, this is not a pretty picture. Let me try and describe why. I entered the workforce in a serious way round about 1983, right when these changes are happening. Most of the time since then, I've made the maximum contribution to Social Security. Now, think about what's happening to my contribution. Part of it is going to pay for Social Security payments for my grandparents. Fair enough. Part of it is being stored up through these surpluses. And in the decade from about, 2010 to about 2025, it will be used to pay Social Security payments to my parents. Fair enough. But when I get to age 65, around year 2025 or 2030, it won't be there to pay for me. So effectively, under the current scheme, I'm given the privilege of paying twice for two generations of retirees, and then when I retire, the system will be, by present calculations, about 30% short of what it needs to pay my benefits. That's not a pretty picture, something we'll have to come to grips with when we talk about the 1990s. One objection here that comes up, it's common to hear people say something like this. Well, Social Security pays for itself. You just said Social Security is running surpluses every year. So how can you possibly say Social Security is part of the deficit problem if it's running surpluses every year? Social Security should be thought of separately. It does its own thing. It's not part of the budget picture. It's true that Social Security is running surpluses, but I think the notion that you can just ignore Social Security is way too simple in terms of ways of looking at the world. After all, Social Security is a very popular program. It's growing very rapidly and dramatically. It's collecting higher taxes. It's paying out higher benefits. Now, if we're going to do that with Social Security, we only have a couple choices with other programs. Either we can also keep raising taxes for those other programs and keeping them at high levels, which means overall our tax burden will be rising, or we can try and clamp down on those other programs. So the overall tax burden stays the same, but Social Security has a bigger and bigger share of what's going on. Now, you can do whichever of those you want, but I would say that you can't have a rapidly growing and expanding program, expanding rapidly in terms of taxes, expanding rapidly in terms of spending, and just say, I don't think this has any impact on anything else. Of course it has an impact on everything else. The fact that people are paying such high Social Security taxes is part of the reason they're so bitter about taxes in general. Part of the reason we don't have money for other things is that, given the current tax burden, Social Security is taking up a larger and larger share of the spending. You have to look at the whole federal budget at once. You can't just sort of take the parts you happen to favor and say they should be left out of the picture. The final cause of the higher government deficits and the strain on fiscal policy is rising government interest payments. Remember, when the government runs a budget deficit, it has to borrow the money. When it borrows the money, then it owes interest on the money that it's borrowed. In 1980s, remember, interest payments go up sharply. They go up because Paul Volcker's decided to beat down inflation, and to beat down inflation by having a monetary policy where what he's going to be able to do is push up interest rates and slow down the economy. Moreover, we're borrowing more and more money. The deficits are getting bigger and bigger. So we have more principal that we're borrowing, and we also have higher interest payments. Well, interest payments go from about $52 billion in 1980. They more than double to $111 billion by 1984, and they almost double again to about $200 billion by 1992. In fact, by the mid-1990s, the interest we're paying on the federal debt is larger than the budget deficit for each year. To put it a little differently, if we had not borrowed the money that we borrowed in the 1980s, and we didn't have to make these interest payments, we would already have a balanced budget in the mid-1990s. So in that sense, our past borrowing is now a contributor to the ongoing size of the budget deficit. Now, What happens as a result of running large budget deficits? I need to disabuse folks of something here, especially in the early 1980s. It was common to hear people say something like, the deficits are like this sword hanging over your head by a thread, and at any moment they could lead to collapse or disaster or ruin. That's not right. Huge deficits are more like having a doctor come and use leeches on you every single day. They gradually slow you down. They gradually drain your energy. For your own health over time, it makes you weaker and weaker and weaker. So deficits are not something which overnight is likely to cause disaster. They're something that slows the economy over time. Let's spell out how that happens. The first path is that large budget deficits crowd out domestic investment, as economists say. When the federal government is borrowing so much money, there's less available for private companies to borrow for investment purposes. It's kind of like what happens when the elephant gets to the drinking fountain first. They drink everything they want and you get whatever's left. The federal government here is the elephant going off and taking that large drink. In relation to the size of the economy, private business investment is actually down in the 1980s, partly because of this effect of the federal government sucking up all the extra revenue. And clearly, if we invest less, we're going to end up with lower long-term rates of growth. A second difficulty: a high budget deficit leads to a trade deficit. Now, there's no question that trade deficits drastically shoot up in the 1980s. The standard measure of the trade deficit, called the current account balance, goes from a small surplus of about $5 billion in 1981 to a small deficit of about $11 billion in 1982. And then all of a sudden, there's a $44 billion deficit in 83, a $100 billion deficit in 84, a $125 billion deficit in 1985, and deficits that are at least that large or larger through 1988. What happened? Why did the trade deficit decay so rapidly in the early 1980s? Most of the public discussion of trade offers an explanation that economists think is deeply wrong. The explanation a lot of people give is other nations got a lot more unfair all of a sudden. That the reason we have a trade deficit is because of unfair trade from other countries. But remember the history here. Is it really plausible that the whole world suddenly became massively more unfair to the United States by a factor of 5 or 10 times over a period of 2 years in the early 1980s, right in the middle of while we've got these GATT agreements and other agreements that we're negotiating? I mean, that's just not a plausible story. You don't look at the other countries and see trade barriers that they suddenly raised up in order to keep out our goods or anything like that. It's just not a reasonable story to say that somehow, all of a sudden, everyone became more unfair in some subtle way that we can't point out, and that created the trade deficit. Instead, to economists, trade deficits are caused by macroeconomic factors. The argument is that a trade deficit is what happens when a nation consumes more than it produces. Again, think about that. We've talked about it in some of the earlier lectures. A trade deficit is when you've got a situation where you're importing more than you're exporting. If you import more than you export, then what you're consuming, your imports, is bigger than your exports, what you're sending out somewhere else. So, a trade deficit means, the meaning of the term is, that you're consuming more than you're producing. Now, what happens if we run really, really large budget deficits? If we run really, really large deficits, we're causing the economy to consume a lot more all of a sudden. Those deficits are a way of borrowing the money from the future and consuming a lot in the present. And those trade deficits are what were driving the economy to consume a lot more than it produced. Because they were spurring up aggregate demand so quickly, the local economy, the U.S. economy, couldn't produce that amount. And instead, we sucked in the exports from abroad to satisfy that extra demand. To conclude in the other direction, if we want to get rid of the trade deficit, then we have to become a country which consumes less and produces more. We could do that, for example, by cutting back the trade deficit and reducing the process. And indeed, what you see during the 1990s as budget deficits go down a little bit is that the trade deficit also begins coming down a little bit. A third consequence of running large budget deficits is that the United States again became a debtor nation. Again, to economists, having a trade deficit literally means that we are consuming more than we are producing. How do we do that? How can you consume more than you produce? Well, you have to borrow the money from somewhere. That's how anyone can consume more than they produce. And in our case, we were borrowing the money from abroad. Consider this simple example. Think about trade in a world with only two countries, Japan and the United States. Japan is producing more than it consumes and exporting the extra. The United States is consuming more than it produces, and we're doing that by importing the extra. Now, how does that work out? Japan is earning extra money that they're not using to buy goods. We need extra money in order to buy the extra goods. What happens is Japan loans us that money. And effectively, the way you can have a trade deficit over and over and over is by borrowing the money from abroad and having an inflow of capital. Now, I should emphasize that this connection, that when you have a trade deficit and you're borrowing money from abroad, this is not a theory about how the economy works. This is a commonly conceded fact that if you understand the terms themselves, it has to be true. And the connection just is necessarily so, pretty much from what the meaning of the words are. Now, borrowing money from abroad is not always a bad thing. After all, the U.S. financed a lot of its growth in the 19th century by borrowing money from abroad to build railroads. Countries like Korea financed a lot of their growth by borrowing money from abroad. So you can definitely borrow money from abroad, and if you invest it wisely in your economy, then things can work out fairly well. But when a rich country like the United States is borrowing all this money and using it basically for purposes of consumption, then we're not borrowing the money for future investment. Instead, we're borrowing it really to consume now. And what happens when you borrow way too much and you don't invest in the future is that at some point in the future, you need to pay back those loans. And at that point in the future, your standard of living will be lower as a result of having borrowed the money. So the argument here is that deficits slow down long-run growth. They do it for a couple of different reasons. There's less investment because we're end up borrowing more from abroad and we're going to have to pay that off. And we're going to have lower growth in the future as a result. Remember that the growth slowdown started in the 1970s, but the size of the deficits certainly helped continue that growth slowdown through the 80s and into the 1990s. In fact, one of the reasons it may be so hard to come up with good reasons why growth slowed down is that perhaps there's a series of reasons happening over time that sort of overlap each other, and so it's hard to come up with one reason that you can sort of put in a nice bottle and hold on to. The other major change, I think, of the Reagan years and of 1980s in general is that there's something of a change in how we think about markets and how we think about deregulation. Now, actually, a lot of this deregulation you would have to give credit for to the Carter administration and the Democrats in the late 1970s. They're the ones who, in the late 1970s, passed laws deregulating airlines, deregulating trucking, deregulating banking, deregulating oil prices. All of those are passed in the late 1970s under Jimmy Carter and with the full support of some well-known liberals like Edward Kennedy. But it's in the 1980s that the effects of these deregulations become apparent. And so let's tell some stories about deregulation of these different industries and get a sense of how we were thinking about markets toward the end of the 1980s. For example, let's talk about airline deregulation. The airlines had been regulated since the 1930s by the Civil Aeronautics Board, one of the boards set up during the New Deal flurry of legislation by Franklin Roosevelt. The Civil Aeronautics Board, the CAB, used to control who could fly every interstate route in the country. They approved all fares. They approved when you could come and when you could go. They approved what routes you could fly. They had really complete control over what airlines were going to do. And they essentially allowed no new airlines to enter the market for major interstate flights between the 1930s and the late 1970s. In 1978, we pass an Airline Deregulation Act. At the time, one of the things people point to, which is interesting, is that the regulated airlines, because they can't compete on offering a lower price, they're competing by offering great service. You know, they're competing by offering, you know, remember the time, you know, cute flight attendants who walk around and treat the businessmen really nice by bringing them drinks and dinners and things like that. Those days, of course, are going to go away when you have to start worrying about cutting costs. Meanwhile, intrastate carriers, carriers inside states like California and Texas, are flying routes that are, they're basically charging about half as much per mile flown as the interstate carriers are, because they have to compete with each other. They can't just depend on the government to avoid competition. So what happens after we deregulate the airlines? We stop regulating the prices they charge and the routes they can fly. The first thing that happens is there's an enormous boom of new airlines. Airlines like People Express, if you remember that name. Airlines that fly these little routes back and forth. They do no-frills flights. They offer no food and quick check-in. And there's an enormous number of airlines that start up like this. Fares come crashing down with all this extra competition. The service level also comes crashing down in some ways. You don't get pampered the way you used to. In 1978, there are 30 large airlines, but that number zooms upward in the early 1980s, up to nearly 100 airlines. However, then things turn around, and toward the middle and the later part of the 1980s, all these airlines start merging together. And after all these mergers are completed, it's true that by the 1990s, 90% of the airline industry's passenger miles will be flown by just 8 carriers. So there's an explosion in competition, and then there's a contraction, or what looks like a contraction in competition. Now, this is still, in deregulatory terms, something of a success. After all, before deregulation, only 28% of air passengers traveled between cities that were served by 3 or more air carriers. Right now, about 55% of air passengers are going between cities served by 3 or more carriers. Before deregulation, almost half of all passengers traveled on airlines that carried 70% or more of the traffic on that route. Today, fewer than a fifth of passengers carry on an airline which covers 70% of the traffic on that route. Under regulation, what had been happening was that people were focused a little bit too much on traveling on one particular airline, and no competition entered in. Now, passengers are saving literally billions of dollars a year in lower airline fares. Planes are also flying more full. Before deregulation, the typical plane was about half full. By the late 1980s, it was more like two-thirds full. What's worth remembering here is that business doesn't like competition. And so business tried to free itself up from competition in various ways. It tried to find other ways of avoiding competition as time went on. So, for example, airlines set up these hub systems. Like, I'm based in Minneapolis, and I, you know, pretty much have to fly Northwest a lot of places because they're hubs there. And so they're the ones with all the nonstop flights. They set up frequent flyer miles. They set up computer reservation systems that forced or encouraged people to come to their airlines. They set up incentives for travel agents. And so while we do have more competition than we had in the mid-1970s, it's still true that the rules of competition are varying back and forth. And we need to think about how those rules can vary over time if what we're going to do is get good competition in the industry. So I guess I would say airline competition has been a success, but I'm not sure I would call it a 100% success. It's more like an 80% success with a work in progress. Another story of deregulation is the story of the aftermath of what happened when they deregulated the savings and loan industry. If you've ever seen the movie It's a Wonderful Life and Jimmy Stewart in that movie, you know what a savings and loan is supposed to be. It's supposed to be an industry where people from the community put in their money and the savings and loan loans it back out to the community for housing loans. And laws were passed during the Great Depression to require savings and loans would not pay more than about 5% interest and that they were required to take that money and invest it in people's home mortgages, loan it out to people for their home mortgages. So they could sort of make a quiet profit. Savings and loans are basically a pretty boring business. But in the late 1970s and early 1980s, interest rates go way up. People start pulling money out of savings and loans, and they put it into money market accounts and cash management accounts and mutual funds and anywhere they can get a return which is higher than the 5%, which, remember, is the return that they're limited to paying under the law. The savings and loans are bleeding. They're losing literally tens of billions of dollars every month. They can't really sell off their mortgage loans either. Remember, a lot of these loans were made during the fixed interest rate days back in the 1960s and early 1970s. These loans only paid maybe 6% interest. So nobody's interested in buying their mortgage loans that pay 6% when the interest rates are up around 10 or 12%. So Congress didn't have much choice. It could either watch savings and loans lose all their deposits and disappear, in which case, because there's federal deposit insurance, they would have to pay money to all the depositors, or they could deregulate the savings and loans and let them have some freedom and some flexibility to try and avoid this problem from happening. So they said, look, you can pay more than 5.25% interest. You can invest in things other than home mortgages. That's what the deregulation was all about. Now, this experiment started off fairly well. Interest rates come gradually back down. A number of savings and loans make sensible investments, and they manage to get themselves back on an even keel again. But some of the savings and loans never recovered, and they became what were known in the trade as the zombie thrifts that sucked the life out of the system. Here's how the zombie thrifts worked. They said, we're running out of money. We're going broke. How can we get more money? Well, obviously, we'll offer a really high interest rate. But now we've promised to pay these people a really high interest rate. How can we get the money to pay that interest rate? Answer, we'll invest in something really risky. If what we invest in pays off, then we'll be able to pay them money and get out of a hole. But if what we invest in doesn't pay off, then what we're going to have to do is go broke. But who cares if we go broke? The government will bail out the depositors anyway. So savings and loans took this gambling, high-risk strategy. They invested in very risky things, and then when it didn't work, they invested in more risky things. They just drove themselves deeper and deeper and deeper into bankruptcy. My point here is that contrary to popular belief, most of the money lost by the savings and loans was not stolen by somebody. It was just intentionally loaned out to very poor risks. It was loaned out to poor risks because these people were desperate to try and get high returns. And when we paid off the savings and loans, we did not pay off the people who owned the savings and loans. We paid off the depositors. We made sure that no depositors lost their money. The cost of that bailout ends up being about $150 billion. Clearly, this is a deregulation that didn't work quite so well as the airline deregulation. On the other hand, as you look back, it's not altogether clear what they could have done differently. They were forced to deregulate by the circumstances of the time. They just deregulated in a way which then led to other problems. A third deregulation, the deregulation of the oil industry. Jimmy Carter had started this by freeing up controls on oil production and prices in the late 1970s. But in 1981, Reagan kind of finished it off by removing all the additional controls. There were dire predictions at the time that the oil companies would take advantage of this, that gasoline prices would double or worse. All the money would go to the OPEC members. They'd be able to charge so much more than they could before. Instead, deregulation broke the cartel, really. What happened? Well, there were a few different factors. One was that confronted with new competition from people who were willing to search for oil in the United States, the OPEC members started underselling each other. Instead of sticking together to keep prices high, they began cheating on the deal. It was also true that the U.S., remember, had started conserving on oil in the 1970s. And so our demand for oil was actually shrinking, even though the economy was going up. And because of this situation where oil prices were now not controlled, a great wave of new global searches for oil began starting. People knew they'd be able to sell it at the market price, so it became worthwhile to hunt for it. In 1983, oil prices plummet back to where they were before 1973, and they've stayed there pretty much ever since. By the mid-1990s, the price of gasoline adjusted for inflation is back to pre-1973 levels, and Americans are giving up on their little Japanese fuel-saving cars and headed back toward minivans and light trucks and things like that. A fourth deregulation story are the stories of antitrust involving IBM and AT&T. Remember that the legal view of antitrust and mergers and acquisitions has been evolving. In the 1960s, remember, people were going kind of overboard on blocking every kind of transaction that happened. This provoked a lot of criticism in the legal profession and the economics profession. And in fact, there's a whole new area of scholarship, law and economics scholarship, which continues on into the 1980s. The basic insights of this were that when we're thinking about whether or not we should break up a company, we need to think about the real amount of competition in that industry. And we shouldn't instead be thinking about what would happen off in the future if there were a whole string of extra cases. There are two major cases in the early 1980s, one involving IBM, one involving AT&T. The IBM case had started in 1969. Remember, that's back near the peak of the enthusiasm for antitrust enforcement at the time. But IBM fought it vigorously for 13 years. The government side was that IBM had 3/4 or more of the national market for large general-purpose computer systems, like mainframes. The industry side was, well, that may be true, but we only have 1/3 of the market for all computing projects, if you add up everything like adding machines and handheld calculators. Also, IBM argued, we haven't done anything nasty. We haven't done any predatory practices. Now, that's not so clear that that was true. They had often tied together their products in certain ways that looked like a little bit of a predatory practice. But they certainly, by the standards of John Rockefeller and Standard Oil, they'd been pretty good citizens. The main factor was, though, that as they fought out this case, the industry evolved. It's quite possible that IBM was guilty of monopolizing the market by 1969, but by 1982, by the time a company called Apple Computer was mass merchandising something called a personal computer all across the country, and IBM was diving in the market, it certainly argues that they no longer had monopolistic control at that time. So the government basically gave up its case in 1982. It agreed that, you know, IBM was no longer in danger of monopolizing the market. The great irony here, of course, is that maybe IBM should have broken itself up. Maybe it would have been a stronger competitor if it had done so in 1982. The breakup of AT&T is a little bit different. AT&T does agree to break itself up in 1982. The $150 billion company breaks itself up into seven regional companies, sometimes called the Baby Bells, which provide local service, and focuses itself on the long-distance market and the equipment market, and that's what AT&T officially became. Back in 1984, people made dire predictions about this. There was a headline in one magazine that said, "Why Your Phone Bills Will Soar." It predicted that the breakup would increase phone bills by 50% in 2 years, the cost of phone service might triple in some areas, and experts were testifying before Congress that maybe 15% of Americans would have to give up phone service altogether because of the rate increases. Of course, that's not what happened. The greater degree of competition meant that, especially in long distance services, rates came down and down and down very sharply. Local service had been sort of subsidized in the AT&T system. What they used to do was charge less for local and more for long distance, and then funnel the money across to pay for local service. So the costs of local service do go up to some extent. But for most people, overall, when you take those two into account, their phone bills went down. Even more, there's a flood of innovation in the telecommunications industry. Some of it's silly but fun. Like, you know, remember when the only phone you could get was black and your choice was, do you want it to sit on a shelf or hang on the wall? Now you have, you know, all different colors, styles, phone call waiting, cordless phones, hookups to the internet, all those kinds of things. Deregulation has really been a great spur to technological process. A final change in markets in the 1980s are all the mergers and leveraged buyouts that happened during that time. Remember, the view of antitrust has shifted. Lots of law professors are saying, you know, we should just let these companies go and do what they want to do. It was fairly clear from government surveys at the time that big companies are not taking over the economy. Instead, if you look at things like how much of the market does the Fortune 500 have, they have a shrinking share of the market over this period of time. There's also an argument that, you know, the losses from monopoly are maybe not as bad as we had thought. Often there's competition lurking nearby, like the competition which destroys IBM, not destroys it, but certainly weakens IBM drastically. Between 1980 and 1988, the number of mergers and corporate transactions per year nearly tripled, and the dollar value of those deals increases sevenfold. Since then, of course, right after that, the number and value of deals falls back to the levels that prevailed in the early 1980s. Well, we already said that the merger wave of the 1960s turned out to be not such a good idea. What about this boom in the 1980s? Did that turn out to be a good idea? And the short answer is, we can't really tell yet, because you probably need about 20 years of seeing how things were reshaped and what patterns formed before you can honestly say. But one thing definitely happened in all of these mergers and takeovers. The thing that often happened was that companies ended up paying out money to shareholders. Often when one company bought another, that meant they went to the shareholders of the company that was being purchased and they said, okay, here, you know, you get all this money for your shares. So one way of thinking about what happened in a lot of these mergers and takeovers was they involved paying out money from the corporate sector out to shareholders. Now, is that a good thing or not? By and large, economists argued that probably was a good thing. And the reason was that there were a lot of companies out there which had a whole lot of corporate cash, and they weren't using it very wisely. And because they weren't using it very wisely, it was better that they were taken over and paid out their money to their shareholders rather than using it unwisely in big offices or Lear jets or big corporate salaries. And that discipline of forcing corporations to pay out money when they have a lot of corporate cash is probably a useful thing to try and do. After all, remember, it's awfully easy if you're a big company to be slack and take the easy road. Mergers and leveraged buyouts and all those kinds of things are a way of forcing you to be more disciplined. Now, are they the best way of making that happen? I doubt it. But I do know that in a capitalist system, they're just about the only way to make it happen. And if you don't have mergers and leveraged buyouts, then basically you're saying to large corporations, you're on your own. Sure hope you behave wisely. And that's probably not the best alternative either. The 1980s are a time when we really cut loose markets and make them work. There's a sense that the market is working extremely well. However, all of our problems of debts, government debts, and programs like Social Security are continuing to pile up on us. And that's the problem we'll need to resolve as we head into the 1990s.